following is a presentation of Refuge Calvary Chapel Huntington Beach with Pastor Bill Welsh. For more information about our ministry, please visit refugefamily.com.
Open your Bible, please, to the book of Genesis. And we are in, like I said, chapter 32. Let me turn this on. And title of the message is basically the same as last week. We just added one word. The long road home continues, because we just barely got started on it. And there might be, we'll see how far we get tonight. You know, the nice thing about going through just verse by verse, and I've kind of taken back the teaching through on Wednesday nights, is that wherever I stop, I'll just pick up there next time. I don't have anybody else's schedule to worry about on the Wednesday night. And so my goal, like I said last week, I know two of you were quick to tell me I failed last week, and I knew it. We went 2 minutes past we went 4 minutes past what I had said was going to be our end time, which was going to be 7:58, and I think we got out of here at 2 minutes after. But other than my good friends who told me when we actually ended, anyway, Genesis chapter 32. Oh man, this is such a great story. And I'm glad we're taking our time to walk through it. Last week, one of the things that we talked about at the very, very beginning, and I know that you know this is true too, that the greatest challenges in our life are the relational ones. Really, the biggest ones, the ones that give us the greatest joy when they're good, is relationships. And the ones that give us the greatest grief and worry is relationships. And I mentioned it this way: our deepest hurts have not come from falling down, but from falling out with one another. And that's true. Jacob and Esau, at the point we find them at this point, and you remember their story well, the brothers that did nothing but battle from the time they were womb mates, right? From the time they were together in the womb as twins, not identical twins, they were rumbling with each other constantly. All the way to that terrible breakup that happened in 26 and 27. But Jacob and Esau are at the turning point, really the re-turning point in their relationship, where they're going to reunite tonight, hopefully. This is the return of a prodigal, but actually it's a return of two prodigals, because neither one of them were really great boys, you know, in their father's and mother's eyes. You remember Esau was the one that made up his own route through life, and he brought grief into the family because of the polygamy that he practiced with Hittite women, which were beyond the covenant. And it was so important that they stay within the family of the covenant. And Esau says, I don't need to listen to mom and dad. I'll do whatever my passions tell me to do. And he married these two gals in Genesis 26 and then 27. When Jacob is ready to leave, mom who says something like this. Oh, maybe she's talking to Jacob. Oh, honey, if he goes off and he marries someone that's out of the covenant too, this is just going to be such a mess if he goes outside of our family. And so Jacob, the schemer, as he headed out off to Paddan Aram, which is on the other side, way on the other side of the Jordan River, Jacob, the schemer, had totally ruined the relationship between the two brothers with his last great big scheme. And Genesis 32 and 33 is such a wonderful, rare scene in the Bible where there's a reunion between people who have split and gone different ways. There's a hint of a reunion between brothers that had split in anger and gone different ways, and that was Paul the apostle and Barnabas, who was also called an apostle. And they had split angry with each other. And you can tell just a few hints in the New Testament that they patched it up. And they acknowledged one another again. We don't have all the details of that reunion. But Genesis 22, or 32 and 33 is that rare scene of the reunion of warring brothers. There are 20, think about it. How many of you have ever had a season of separation between friends and you were able to work it out? Let me see the hands of those that you got a great story there, I'm sure. Did it last 20 years? It was a 20-year separation. Now, certainly geographical separation kept them from having any contact in the days before anything but smoke signals, which wouldn't reach as far away as Jacob had gone. But you remember these two guys and the deep, deep trouble that they had, that have how they'd wrestled their whole life through. It was their history. It's just the way that they were. Maybe you've had puppies like that, or kittens like that, or pets that just were always at one another. Well, those were these two guys. Now, Jacob is finally, and this is beautiful, he's probably the wrong reason. He's had it up to here with Uncle Laban, who has schemed him. He schemed the schemer royally, and he's just desperate to get out of there. But he's finally heading home, and he's realizing that he has to face the music. This wrestler's heart is beginning to change. We'll talk about that at the end of our time tonight, and how many different ways he learned something from God. But there is one more wrestling match, and that wrestling match is on the way home with a very formidable opponent. And that opponent, he tells us, is God. But he follows a simple path, as he as the same path that we follow. You know why you came to Christ? Well, there's an awful lot of sovereignty behind you coming to Christ, and God doing work that you weren't even aware of until the moment that he woke you up. But that's the moment. That moment that you came to your what? Senses. God awoken, he awakened you, and you came to your senses, and you were finally aware that it was God that was doing something. Thank God that Jacob had finally come to his senses. He's awake now, and he's aware. Or like our new word. Anybody ever track with this? Every year, at the end of a year, and especially at the end of a decade, but at the end of a year, there's an article that tells you about all the brand new words that finally made their way into our vocabulary enough that it was put into dictionaries. And one of the words that you heard over this last year probably a whole lot was the word woke. Did anybody hear the word woke? They're so woke now. And I looked it up. I kind of knew what woke meant, but to use their words, Jacob is finally woke. He's aware. Here's one of them. Here's one of the uses of the word woke in a sentence. We have a moral obligation to stay woke. That means to stand and be active, challenging injustice and racism and fighting hatred and discrimination. It really is a kind of good word. The second one, though, says Brad Pitt is not only woke, he's the wokest man in Hollywood. I think that was before last week when Ricky Gervais woke a whole bunch of actors and producers and directors with his tirade at the Golden Globes. But they are definitely woke. And let's look at this together now. Verse 1 through 8. I know you want Bible tonight. Anybody want Bible tonight? Good. Verse 1 through 8. I'm just going to read it, and then we'll dive into it. So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, that's on the other side of the Jordan River, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Speak thus to my lord Esau." Can you see a change in the attitude of Jacob? In that he calls his brother what? Lord. And he's going to call himself his lord's servant. That's a new vocabulary for this brother. So he says, "Say to my lord Esau, thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord," there he goes again, get used to it, he's going to say it a bunch of times, "that I may find favor in your sight." And then the messengers returned to Jacob. They'd gone on this mission. They returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he's also coming to meet you." Listen to this. "And 400 men are with him." And so Jacob was woke. No, it doesn't say that. But Jacob was greatly afraid. Trust me, he was woke at that point. And he was distressed. And he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. And he said, "If Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company, which is left, will escape." Father, I pray tonight as we are in your word now, that by your spirit, you would drive the truth of your word that comes from your heart into our hearts. In Jesus' name, amen. Walk through this quickly. Angel on the path. It's just an appearance of these angels. Doesn't say much about a conversation at this point anyway, but it wakes him up. He realizes, oh, this is a special place. And he names a place Mahanaim, which means a place of two camps, double camps. He could be speaking about his brother's camp and the other camp, but he doesn't know about his brother's camp and his brother's group of 400 yet. I don't think that it's so much his camp and his brother's camp. I think it's the two companies that he's getting ready to put together, like we just read. He's dividing everything he has into two groups, at least the people, all and certainly all of those animals as well. And it says it right in there that here's the deal, if he attacks, maybe I can keep at least one company away from him. If my brother is on his vendetta mission to take me down like he promised 20 years ago, at least maybe there's a possibility if I split them all up, I'll have some to keep for myself. And then in verses 3 to 8, it's Jacob doing the best that he can without the help of God. I'm going to divide them here. I'm going to divide them there. Go get the information. The information comes back to him. It's your brother. And I think it's very, very safe to bet that Jacob, when he heard your brother's not just coming with a few friends, he's coming with an army. He's coming with a group of 400 to meet you. And maybe they saw this from a distance. I don't know that Jacob's people went in among them and asked for information. But you can tell that he's afraid by what he's about to say in just a moment. Look at verses 9 through 12. This is where that was Jacob setting the stage. This is Jacob finally getting honest with God. And this is so powerful to me. Jacob now is praying. It says, then Jacob said, "Oh God," and I think you could have heard a tremble in his voice at that point. "Oh God of my father Abraham and the God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you.' I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff." He said, that's all I had, a stick in my hand when I came across. "And now I have become two companies." And he says, "Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother and from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, 'I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered by multitude.'" This is Jacob getting very, very honest with God. And I love the way that he says it, the way he admits to God that he's afraid. Look at there. He says verse 9, "God, you called me back. You gave me a promise to come back from the land where I was with my brother. You called me back here. You made a promise to me, and I wasn't worthy." I love that about him. He's so honest. He says, "I am not worthy before you." He says, "I know that." And it's interesting to me, too, that he doesn't say, "God, you're my God." But he says, "You're my father's God, and you're my grandfather's God." They came to a place with him where they did what? They had surrendered to God. And I don't know that you see the surrendered Jacob at this point. You will see the surrendered Jacob. It's going to come through that wrestling match. But he says, "I am not worthy of all the least of these mercies." In other words, he's saying, "You've been way too good to me. You've blessed me beyond my wildest dreams. I had nothing when I came, just a stick in my hand. And now look at all these people." And then he says, "Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother." He is so sure that his brother's out to get him. So the next thing makes sense. He says, "Deliver me from my brother, from the hand of Esau, because I'm afraid." He says, "God, I'm afraid." I think I heard Pastor Chuck say this a long time ago. He said, "I believe that an honest, negative confession is far better than a dishonest, positive confession." Now, that was back in the days where Chuck could see one of the biggest theological challenges among the church at that point was what was called the positive confession movement. You just confess, confess, confess what is not real, confess it as real until it becomes real. If you're sick, just confess that you're healed. If you're poor, just confess that you're rich. And I agree with Chuck. and I agree with the scripture. I agree with Jacob here. Admit the truth. He said, I'm afraid and I'm not worthy, but you're a God who made promises to me. You promised you would bring me back to this land. He kind of puts his prayer between two promises in verse 12 where he says, for you said, I will surely treat you well, and there's going to be a bunch of you, more than the sands on the seashore. And I think that is just so powerful. When Jacob in his prayer just says, God, this is who I am, and God, this is what you said, so I'm going to rest my fears and my unworthiness between your promises. But I want to tell you who I know that I am. I'm not a worthy man. Have you come to that place with God? I wonder how many of us feel like, God, I'm so good, you owe me the world. I hope you wouldn't be that audacious to say that. It all starts with humility. And I love the way that he says, God, you promised, and here's me, and God, you promised. You promised me a land. You promised me a multitude that would come from me. And it has to happen the way that you planned. Then verse 13 to 21, the schemer schemes again. Okay, he has prayed, but how many of you got perfect the first time you prayed? Did you get over all your stuff the first time you prayed? I want to see a show of hands. I got to do this at least once tonight, or you won't think you're in the right church, right? But how many of you have prayed for God to do something in your life over and over and over again? You've prayed it and prayed it and prayed it and prayed it. And maybe some of the things you're praying right now, you don't see the fulfillment of it yet. And so you didn't get completely, you know, set right the first time. Well, that's this man. You're going to see him scheme a little bit longer. Next section in verses 13 to 23 is this schemer scheming again. So he lodged there that same night and took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother. They began to bring just all the stuff that he had to him. And he began to sort of, he's wrapping a bow around all these, this massive gift that he's going to send to his brother in waves. It says droves, but that was a name for the groups of different animals. But they're going to come in wave after wave after wave and trying to wow his brother with all the peace offerings he's bringing to him or sending to him. And so he took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother. Look at this, 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, that's a female sheep, 20 rams, the male sheep, 30 milk camels with their colts. Anybody ever had camel milk? I'm just not interested yet. With all the new milks they've got in the coffee shops around here, I just hope camel milk doesn't show up or they don't sneak it in on me someday. Maybe it's great, I don't know. 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, and 10 foals of those donkeys, of course. And then he delivered them to the hand of his servants. And this is just so classic. Every drove by itself. So I get the idea that maybe it's the female goats first, keeping the female goats and the male goats from each other. I was over in North Carolina and visited a place called Connemara. And Connemara was the last place that the poet Carl Sandburg lived. And they got out of Chicago and decided we got to go. He was getting really, really popular in those days. And we got to go somewhere where nobody knows me. And so they hid away in the hills near Flat Rock, North Carolina. And his wife had begun to experiment with raising goats because she enjoyed goat's milk as a child. It was better on her stomach. She ended up with 200 milk goats, and they started a milk goat dairy farm there. And I don't know why I told you that. You didn't need to know that, but there was something I was going to say about that. Oh, yes. I was touring the place, and they don't have as many goats now. But I was talking to one of the, I guess it's a docent that was out in the barnyard area, you know, doing tours and all that. And I said, so you got the male goats over there. And I said, so you got the female goats over here? He said, oh, yeah, because she's in heat, or they're in heat, and these guys know it. And so you got to keep them separate at that point. So maybe they were sent out in gender groups, the female goats and the male goats, but drove by drove, they were delivered to his brother. He said to the servants, pass over before me and put some distance between successive droves. And he commanded the first one saying, when Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going? And whose are these in front of you? and the animals. Then you shall say, here he goes. Remember, Jacob had called them Lord. He says, they are your servants, Jacob. Now, Jacob, remember when all this happened? And Jacob is strutting around like, who's Lord now? Who's got the birthright now, big brother? He does. But he has come to his senses, like I said. He says, just tell him it's from his servant, Jacob. It's a present sent to my Lord Esau. And behold, he's behind us. So here's your script. Just say this when you see him. And so he commanded the second and the third and all who followed the drove, saying, in this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And also say this, throw this in. Behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. And afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. Can you imagine hearing that from a messenger whom your brother has sent? Now, you remember the last thing you said to him. And he remembers the last thing you said to him, that I will kill you as soon as dad's dead. Dad is not dead yet. But this is Esau assuming that there's still muddy water between them. And he says, this is what you tell him. You tell him all of this comes from your brother because he's hoping that there's a possibility of a reunion between the two of you. Read it one more time, that last sentence. Say this to him as well. I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Afterward, I will see his face, and perhaps, maybe, Esau will accept me. So the present went on over before him, but he himself lodged that night in the camp. And he arose that night and took his two wives. Now this is strange to me. He arose that night and he took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. That's still on the east side of the Jordan, very close to the city of Ammon today. And he took them, sent them over the brook, and sent over what he had. And then the wrestling match is about to begin. Now, here's the strangest thing to me. He puts his family out in the line of possible harm. I don't think we see the new Jacob yet. He sent on the animals, he sent on the gifts to appease his brother, and then he sent his family between him and the front lines, supposing that there's the possibility of a front line of battle. And then he's all by himself on the other side. And this is where it gets so good. What you're about to see, though, is Jacob getting close to the land of promise. And to me, that is just such an amazing thing. So far, this is damage control. And this is staging and a good amount of drama. Would you agree with me? There's a good amount of drama in the script that he's written. Say this, not that. Say this, and then say this. And just make sure you bring them all. Let's separate them because that'll be more of a parade, like a big old rose parade, and we'll just bring him everything. It'll take a long time, and it'll just maybe soften his heart. But I love the way it opens up in verse 24. And then Jacob, read this with me. And then Jacob was left alone. Oh, that is such a good place to be with God. And God has a way of getting us alone when there's something he needs to dig into. When there's something he wants to get at in us, he says, step into my surgical theater and let me dig down into that. And mama doesn't usually get to go into the surgical theater with you. It's you alone with the doctor and the staff. And so it's Jacob, and he's all alone. Keep that in your mind. And a man wrestled with him. We're going to find out who the man was. You know the secret. This is nothing new to you. It is God. That's who he says it is at the end. Either a theophany, obviously, of God wrestling with him in the form of a man, but he's having a personal encounter with God at this point. And they wrestled with him until the breaking of day. And now when he saw that he, that's Jacob, when he saw that he did not prevail against him, not he, this is God, when he saw that he did not, in other words, that Jacob's not giving up, he's not giving in easily, when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip. And the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he kept wrestling. And Jacob is still not giving up. But this gets so good. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. This is God speaking that. And then Jacob says, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Picture this. They're wrestling. I don't know what position they're in on the ground, but rolling on the ground. And God is saying, you're not giving up easy. I have my ways. You remember David in Psalm 51, where he says something about the bones that you have broken. One day the bones that you have broken will rejoice. But he says, purge me, God. Purge me. Make me clean. All kinds of scrub me down words in Psalm 51. And then he says, and then I'll teach sinners. When the bones that you've broken are mended and when they rejoice. David had been broken. I think it was probably Charles Swindoll, which was the first one I ever heard say this. It wasn't originally from Chuck Swindoll. Somebody else had said it. He said, I doubt that God can use a man greatly until he has hurt him deeply. And this sounds like a sadistic God, but it's not what it is. It's God breaking in us what needs to be broke so that we can be prepared to be used by him. And all of us are in that place. It's not just, you know, God beating us up. It's God melting us down so that he can get to the things that he needs to get to. So he's all alone, and God reaches down, and he puts his hip out of place, and he keeps on wrestling. And then you hear Jacob say this, I won't let you go until I have your blessing. I won't let you go until you bless me. I love doing that to people. Not the hip part. But I'll walk up behind my kids. I'll walk up sometimes behind a friend, put my arms around them. They can't see who I am, and I'll say, I won't let you go until you bless me. I remember the day that I did that to our youngest daughter, Starlin, and she was, I think, in junior high over here at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. And I came up behind her, and I hugged her, and I said, I won't let you go until you bless me. And she put her hand right on my hip, just like that. She'd read that story in Bible study at church. I thought, whoa, this girl is woke. No, I didn't say that at that time, but this girl is aware. She's aware. But strange moves between God and this man whom he's wrestling at that point. And so he says, I won't let you go until you bless me. Now listen to the conversation as it goes on. God says to him, so what's your name? Did God need to know his name? Do you think God might have known the name of the man that he's wrestling with all night long? Yeah. But why does he say, tell me your name? What's his name mean? It means what? Heel catcher. Supplanter. The one that's always reaching out for somebody else's blessing. He says, let me ask you, hey, what is your name? And he has to say it. This is my name. I'm a schemer. I'm a heel catcher. I'm reaching out for what's mine, what's not mine, as if it were mine. Whew. And he makes him confess. I mean, think about it. Jacob's name was a negative confession. It's a negative truth about what he was. I don't know what the equivalent would be in the Hebrew language for the word jerk. But there were some people whose their names didn't mean something nice. And this is one of them. He says, what's your name? And he's getting to the point. He said, what's your name? He said, I'm Jacob. And he said, well, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you've struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. There was no Israelite until the sons of Jacob were known as the sons of Israel. And by the way, there were no Jews until Jacob's son Judah had children. And then the stream that came from Judah were known as Jews. But now all the tribes of Israel are also known as Jews. So he says, my name is Jacob. And God says, you're no longer the heel catcher. You are now a prince. You're a prince of God. Because I'm giving it to you, not because you're taking it. Because I'm putting you in a place of authority. I'm putting you in a place of leadership. He says, because you have struggled with God and with men and you have prevailed. I'll say this again before we end, but I'll tell you what you find there in that verse is the key on how to win a fight against God. Give up. Surrender. Just tap out. Say, God, you're God. I'm not. I want what you want for my life. And you surrender to his will. And he asked for his, he begged for his blessing. Oh, God, I want your blessing. And then Jacob said in verse 29, well, tell me your name, I pray. I gave you my name, you tell me your name. And he said, why is it that you ask about my name? And he blessed him there. And Jacob found out his name. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. I think you could almost, maybe in a paraphrase, maybe somebody has put it this way in a paraphrase, that God is, it's like God is saying to Jacob, do you really need to know my name? Are you that slow? You don't know who you're wrestling with here? This is God. And he gets it. He understands that it's God who has given him the blessing of the limp, put his hip out of socket. It's God who has thrown him to the ground in order to bless him and to fulfill every word that he has said to him. The thing I love about this is, like the title that I put on this section, is the wrestler gets out wrestled. Jacob, all by himself, great place to be with God. He saw angels on the way into the promised land with the ladder vision of angels going up and down. And it's an upgrade from the angels. He's face to face with God. He saw angels on the way out as well. But it all led to that personal encounter with God. And Jacob wins by surrendering to God that night. All night long, they wrestled until the break of day. And he got his new name. Interesting. He got two new things that night, didn't he? He got the new name of Israel, the Prince of God. He got a new name and he got lame, all in the same night. Here's a scene that I love about this. And I always encourage you to put your mind to work looking around a biblical scene as you're reading it. And imagine the other people there. I was thinking about this, doing the same thing with the text we're going to be in this week. This weekend, there was another part of the trial of Jesus that I never thought of, and I can't wait to share that with you on the weekend. But if you could see Jacob walking down the road, it's like every other step is a limp, even if he's leaning on a stick or on a staff. So every other step is a reminder of that night that he had that encounter with God. And I think he blessed the Lord for the limp that he carried through the rest of his life. I can't tell you how many people I've met who have been through horrible health crisis, cancers, and open heart surgery. You remember Caitlin DeBro, who lost both arms and both legs below the knee, and 60% of her skin from spinal meningitis. And you talk to her. Would she love to have her arms and legs back? Well, of course, who wouldn't? But I remember her saying, not if it meant that I didn't have Jesus. And she blessed God for the challenge that brought her home to him. She would tell the story over and over again of saying that she had a conversation with God that seemed like just almost a verbal thing, and just a blessed holy visitation from the Lord while she was in that hospital for so long. And she said she remembered the very first, I think it was the first day, the Lord asking her, do you want to live? And she said, yes. But she said, I knew it wasn't just, do I want to remain physically alive? She said she knew that what God was asking is, do you want life? Do you want to be saved? And she said, yes. I tell you, I can't wait to see that girl run in heaven. I can't wait to see those arms stretched out to Jesus. And I think Jacob is in the same company. He said, I don't think I would trade the limp if it meant I had to go back to what I was before the limp. And you learn to embrace the wounds. You learn to embrace the bruise, the bruising of God, because he loves us too much to leave us the way that we are. The chastening of the Lord is only to those that, what does the Bible say? He chastens those that he loves. And we need chastening. We need the discipline of God. It's not the abuse of God. It's the love of God to discipline us, to draw us closer into him, to learn his ways. So Jacob, this night, he sent all the kids over and the wife over, and he sent all the animals. Well, you know how old those kids were? Not one of them was over 13. There was probably a couple of toddlers in the bunch. And that's the Jacob that sent them over. Something had changed that night. I want you to flip over with me. Oh, we better make our way to the end here, I guess. Then Jacob asked, tell me your name. And he said, well, you need to ask my name. And in verse 30, he said, so Jacob called the name Penuel. I've seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. And just as he crossed over Penuel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. And therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle, that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank. It just kind of worked itself into folklore and just said that's what they've done from that point on. Now, chapter 33. We've got enough time to do this. This is a very, very brief chapter. It's a different Jacob. You know why it's a different Jacob? Because it's Israel now that's about to head across. He'll still use the name Jacob, but read with me the next three verses. It says, now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maidservants, and he put the maidservants and their children in front, and Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. You see what he's doing there? He's putting them at the back. Why is that? Because Joseph's his favorite. That's why. And the only son that came from that wife until Benjamin would be born much, much later. And so Joseph at the back with his mama Rachel. And then he crossed over. I love this. This is where I see a little bit of change in Jacob at this point. And he crossed over before them. He goes in front of the family and he bows. He bowed himself to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. You need to picture that. You need to imagine that. He kind of pushes through the crowd, leaves the kids and the wives and the concubines. I know we've been through that story. Leaves them all behind. And I'm not going to get down on the ground seven times, because then I'd have to get up seven times. And it's harder now than it used to be. And he walks away and he bows before his brother like a foot servant. And he walks a little further and he bows before his brother seven times as he makes his way face to face with his brother, which is basically he's just saying, I am your servant. I put myself below you. And he's honoring, finally showing some honor towards his older brother. And then the brothers are together again. Oh, verse 4. It is one of the sweetest scenes in the Bible to me. Some of you look forward to reunions like this. And can I say this? I hope you don't wait until heaven to have reunions like this. If you want a reunion like this, start praying for it. What you're about to see is one of the most beautiful sights in all of the Bible. But Esau ran to him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him. Does that scene sound familiar to anybody? What's it sound like? Prodigal son. Except it's not the prodigal son. It's the prodigal sons that are reuniting. He sees him. He's not afar off like in that passage, but he sees him. And Esau, who Jacob has every right to believe, he's at least going to beat me up. He runs to him and he throws his arms around him and he kisses him. And it says, and they wept. I knew I wouldn't make it through this verse. I knew I wouldn't.
picture those two boys right there with no words yet. And one of the most profound and articulate things they did is they greeted each other with a kiss, and they just stood there, arms around each other, weeping. I always tell you this, but when you see the word weep, it doesn't mean a nice little trickle of tears coming down the cheek. You know what you sound like when you weep. You know, fluid runs out of just every pore on your face, right? You know, then the wrong stuff is coming, and they're weeping over each other. There is such joy and such peace and beauty there. And then this would be Esau, he lifted up his eyes and he saw the women and the children. He said, "And whose are these with you?" It's just, I've had, you know, times like that where I met somebody I hadn't seen in a while and said, "And who are these kids?" And so he's looking at the family that has accompanied Jacob, and he said, "And who are these with you?" So he said, "The children whom God has graciously given," he doesn't say me, he still won't say me yet, "your servant, that God has blessed your servant with." And then the maidservants came near and the children and bowed down. And I don't know if he'd trained them to do that. "Now, if you see my brother, I want you all to bow down before him." And then the maidservant, and then verse 7, "And then Leah also came with her children. They bowed down. Afterward, Joseph and Rachel came, and they bowed down." And then Esau said, "What do you mean by all that this company which I met?" And he said, "These are to find favor in the sight of my Lord." And Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." He said, "I don't need any of that." And he's talking about all the animals. "I don't need that to find favor with me. I don't need that. I have all I need." And Jacob said, "No, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand. Inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me." These former enemies that are now friends. I skipped something there. These former enemies that are now friends again. And to hear Jacob, this is so unlike Jacob. This has more Israel written all over it. And Esau saying, "No, I don't want any of it." And he says, "No, please, please take this. I can't believe that I see your face and you're happy to see me. That you've caused your face," like God would say, "to shine upon me." He says, "Please take my blessing that is brought to you because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have enough." And so he, Jacob, urged him, Esau, and Esau said, "Okay," and he took it. You know why I think he took it? It's only surmise. I mean, it's just, you know, you can put your own thoughts to it. I think he took it because he knew how much it meant for this man to bless his brother. He knew how much it meant for him to put it right. And it's kind of like David, a little bit like David, when Arana, the man who owns the threshing floor that David wants to buy to put the tabernacle there, he says, "No, I want to buy it from you, please. I want to buy it from you." He says, "Oh, no, David, you're a wonderful king. I want to give it to you." He said, "No, I won't offer to God that which costs me nothing." The same heart that Jacob has here. "I want to give with all of my heart." And so he let him give it. And then Esau said, "Let us take our journey. Let us go, and I will go before you." And Esau is so settled now. He says, "Come on, brother, we're back together. Let's go home. Let's go see mom and dad together," which they won't for a long time. He says, "Come with me and we'll go together. I'll lead the way." But Jacob said, "My Lord knows that the children are weak." In other words, they'd come from a long journey. "And the children are weak, and the flocks and the herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die." He said, "No, please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure." Is this Jacob caring about somebody else? Caring about even the livestock? "And the children will go in until I come to my Lord at Seir." And Esau said, "Now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Just let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." And so Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed
to Sukkot and built himself a house and made booths for his livestock, and therefore the name of the place is called Sukkot. Sukkot means tent, it means booth, it means shelter, and that's where we get the name for the Hebrew festival of tabernacles, Sukkot. So they've made their way back to one another. And Esau is saying, let's just go together. And Jacob says, no, you go on ahead, and you go your way, and I'll go my way, but we're together again. It means so much to me that there's no more war between us, that the things that were between us, he's saying, you've been so gracious to me, more gracious than I ever, ever could have deserved. And he said, so he went one way, and he went the other. And then it says in verse 18, and I think that's where we catch up to this, says this, then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem. You know what Shechem was? That's where Abraham built his first altar. If it's the same Shechem, it's up north of Jerusalem, in the Judean hills, the mountains that separate the Mediterranean plain from the Jordan River plain. So he went to Shechem, to the place where his grandfather had first built an altar, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city. And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Isn't that interesting? This is such a different man. He's not trying to swindle anybody out of anything anymore. He's paying the price. And there he erected an altar. And he called the name El Elohe. Say that with me. El Elohe Israel. El Elohe Israel. The scene here. Let me walk through it just a little bit with you, through this chapter. This new way that Jacob has finally learned. New name, he'll grow into that name. No question that he'll grow into that name. I can just picture him on the first night after they went separate ways. And the sun is coming up. You know a song he sang that day? The sun comes up, it's a new day dawning. If he'd known it, he would have sung it. And he would have sung the chorus a million times. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Oh, my soul, bless the Lord. God did so much more than he ever could have imagined as these brothers come together and are in harmony again. They've got a ways to go, but we all have a ways to go. But there's change. How many of you can see that? You see that between the two brothers? There is change. So I ask the question as we're closing tonight, is change possible? Can you change? Can I change? You hope so, don't you? I hope so. Got a couple of quotes last week that I was going to share with you. I'm glad I saved them for tonight. I found these in a magazine that you guys are going to think that all I do is sit around and read magazines, right? Last week I talked about the Life magazine. This week it's a magazine that I don't ascribe to much of what's written in it, but I buy it so I can kind of, you know, catch what's going on in the vein of philosophy now, which is the vein of ideas, people looking for answers to what's going on. I think it's called New Philosopher Magazine. And it's always on one particular theme, and the theme is, can we change? Can people really change? And one of the quotes that I found in there was this from Thomas Carlyle, a British writer. He said, change indeed is painful, but it's ever needed. How many of you agree with that? I don't think change is ever easy. Leo Tolstoy said this, everyone thinks of changing the world, but no one thinks about changing themselves. The world needs to be a better place. Well, start with you. And this was Hannah Arendt, She was a German-American philosopher, political theorist, and I love her thought on change. You know, when revolutions come and marching in the streets and fighting in the streets and trying to overthrow governments, and this is so true. We watch this happen. So the most radical revolutionary will become a conservative the day after the revolution. And it happens. It happens over and over again. Last week, though, I mentioned this, and I want to put it before you again. The change and progress stops when we embrace the notion of fate, that you can't change. You're just handed something. Some would say sovereignly. Someone would say by predestination. You're just given this, and everything's set, and nothing you can do. when you accept the notion of fate and you reject the privilege of free will to make choices that really, really make a difference, then change and progress stops at that point. Talked about this last week too, I think. If I want to find myself at a better place in life, then my current path and habits must be abandoned because it will always lead me to the same destinations by way of the same captivating ruts. That's all a habit is a rut. You do it again and again and again in a given situation, and you end up at the same place. And that's where Jacob was. I think that's where his brother was as well. But let's admit it. Let's admit the truth that we're all captive to habits, good ones or bad ones. I hope you have good habits of eating well and resting well and exercising well and speaking nicely to one another. I hope we all have those. And if you don't have them, let's go get them. But many of us are not living the life that we wanted. If you back up to when you were in junior high or high school, or whenever, I don't know when you disconnected and went wild, but for me, it was more like in the middle of high school. And I had an idea about what I wanted to be. But I think that the life that we wanted is so different from the life that we have, and for a very specific reason. Because we have maybe not the life we wanted, we got the life we've chosen through decisions that we made and habits that we established. And maybe you've got a better life than the life you wanted when you were in junior high school because of what Christ has done in you. But truth of the matter is, we make decisions every day that will change our lives. Good ones and bad ones. We were watching a video last week with the pastors, an interview between John MacArthur and John Piper, two guys that have been greatly used by God. And John Piper just dropped a phrase on us. He talked about the danger of cultivating a secret life of sin. Think about that. Cultivating. That means habitually. That's what Jacob was until a wrestling match one night on the far side of the brook of Jabbok. Our habits are either strengthening us right now or weakening us. I think it's so important to face the truth about our habits. And the only way that I think we get set free from those habits and those debilitating character habits even, is we have to run into something hard. You have to hit the breaking point. And either hear God say, or you cry out to God, this is far enough, Lord. I'm sick of this. I'm tired of being where I am. And maybe you would even say, I'm tired of being who I am. I'm ready for you, Lord, to do whatever has to happen. And I think the motivation for change comes in all kinds of forms. It comes in trauma. It comes in crisis and loss, a sudden catastrophe. It comes sometimes from an education. You're sitting in a class and just a teacher, a professor, or a friend, or a mentor. I'm not going to go into a long plug for the mentor, conference again. But somebody teaches you something, and it's like suddenly you're awake. It's an epiphany, and you realize, how did I miss this all this time? And there's this awareness of where I'll end up if I don't change my directions. How many of you have had change in your life when you had one of those moments of realizing, if I stay on this track, I will spend my life in prison? That was me in the summer of 1970. And I had no power to change my habit as a thief. I couldn't break it, but I cried out for help. I didn't want to say, God, you've heard me tell the story. I cried out to Charlie. I just didn't want to say God. I didn't want to say Jesus. So I looked up to the heavens and said, Charlie, whoever you are. Isn't that a profound prayer? And I've said this before as well. I think God's, as the phone was ringing in heaven and it was me calling for Charlie, God says, I know who he wants. I'll take that call. And he answered the cry of my heart in the confusion. Or maybe a testimony of someone who's escaped what's holding you. If you hear those testimonies, if you have that testimony, share that testimony. Why? It'll give somebody hope and motivation to move forward. I think the greatest weapon against all of this is the grace of God. And the change comes as we lean heavy upon the grace of God. I told you I was going to go into a list of things that Jacob learned. I'll save that till next time so I can end on time. I'm really determined, aren't I? But I want you to sing a song with me. It was tonight. I posted this. If you guys are on Facebook or Instagram, I I've started a little devotional stream this year that I'm calling Refuge Reflections, and I'm putting one up every day. And today I put this, just the lyrics of this song up. First time this year I've put a song lyric up there. But I want to ask you to sing this with me. And it's a cry from our heart to God. And what I mentioned in the Devo is that that I wrote this song probably 30 plus years ago, but still today it's the cry of my heart. It really is the desperate cry of my heart that I want to go deeper in Christ. I want to go deeper in service to Him. And so let's all stand together. It goes like this. Do a deep work in my heart. Go beyond all my defenses. I drop my mask, oh Lord, I ask. Do a deep work in my heart. Next verse. Do a deep work in my heart. Take me out beyond the shallows. I drop these cares, Lord, take me there. Do a deep work in my heart. And this is from the Psalm of David. And I will know joy again. And I will sing songs of gladness again. And I will be clean when the bones you have broken rejoice. Next slide. Do a deep work in my heart. Sing that to Him. I'm standing here unguarded. I need so much to trust Your touch. Do a deep work in my... Sing that verse again. Do a deep work in my heart. Go beyond all my defenses. I drop my mask, oh Lord, I ask. Do a deep work in my heart. Sing, I'm standing here unguarded. I'm standing here unguarded. Take me out beyond these shallows. Go beyond all my defenses. Do a deep work in my heart. Do a deep work in my heart. Anybody tonight that wants the Lord to do a deep work in your heart, and you're ready for Him to go beyond your defenses, you're ready for Him to take you out beyond the shallowness where you find yourself, lift both hands up to Him right now. I'm not looking to see whose hands are up. Stretch your hands out to Him and let's ask Him tonight. Lord, our hands are lifted before You right now because we're reaching out for You and towards You, Lord. You have been far too good to us, Lord. Far greater, far better than we deserve, Lord. But that's who You are. You're a gracious God, a forgiving God, a powerful God, a loving God. And Lord, we ask You to take us deeper. Take us beyond the shallows, Lord. Go beyond our defenses. We stand before You unguarded, from You at least, Lord. We don't put up any resistance or any guard between You and us. Have Your way, Lord. Mend relationships that we need to have mended, so we can walk forward together. Have Your way in Jesus' name. We are Yours. Amen. 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 But please hang around and pray for one another. And if you don't have somebody standing with you that can pray with you, turn to each other and just confess, hey, I want to ask you to join with me and agree with me for this difference in my life, or to pray for my son, or to pray for my daughter to return and to show me how to reach them. So spend some time with one another, and I ended 1 minute earlier than last year. So I'm on the way, okay? this old dog can learn a new trick, and we'll just see if he can run with it very long. Grace and peace to you. God bless you.
This has been a presentation of Refuge Calvary Chapel Huntington Beach with Pastor Bill Welsh. For more information about our ministry, please visit refugefamily.com or call 714-891-9495.